Gals o' Mine. I'm enjoying a lovely cup of hot chocolate and peppermint schnapps to warm up my innards, and I'm recording from the garage of a friend's place out in the country where I'm house-sitting for a few days. So you may hear periodically a car driving by or ticking clock. And I'm so grateful that I'm not in an area inundated with snow. My thoughts go out to all of you who are challenged with the white stuff right now. I spoke with a few Burning Man fans recently, and of course they discussed, among other things, the chilly nights and hot days faced at the annual event. If you've been a little curious about Burning Man, this roundtable discussion may answer a few questions. I first asked them to provide their names and occupations to provide you insight into the diversity of Burning Man attendees.
I am Jennifer Abbott, and I am 40 years old this year, 2014. And my job is a business analyst.
My name's Dave. I work for the state of California. I've been going to Burning Man since 2005. I work as an environmental scientist.
My name is Candace, and I'm a clinical pharmacist at one of the hospitals in town.
How long have you been going to Burning Man?
Since 2003.
My name is Tara. I am a ceramic artist, student, and single mom. So I've been following Burning Man since 2001. My best friends went and just waiting till I could go. And I finally went in 2012 and then took my kids this year, 2014.
I'm Deb Coughlin. I'm 50 years old. The first time I went to Burning Man was 1998, and I've been there 7 times since. In my day-to-day life, I work in social services and also kind of do artwork on the side.
Well, let's start with a little bit of the history of Burning Man. What was the original intent and location?
It was Baker Beach in, I believe, 88, 87-ish time frame, and a gentleman by the name of Larry Harvey and some of his friends, who off the top of my head I can't remember their names, basically decided to build a big wooden man structure out on the beach, and it was just a few friends at the time that did it. And it was, I don't even know if at that time it was over Labor Day, but it was in the summertime, and they just had a beach burn. But then it got out word of mouth and it kept growing, and I believe it was 1990 that the San Francisco did not allow them to have that again. So they had paired up with the Cacophony Society in San Francisco, and they had already been doing what they called zone trips out to the Black Rock Desert in Nevada, where Burning Man currently is right now. And I believe it was Michael, who was one of the friends, he goes now by Danger Ranger, and a few others, John Law, and ones I can't remember off the top of my head right now. But they all ended up going out there, and it was only a few hundred, maybe pushing 1,000 people that decided to go, like those first few years. By the time I went in 1998, there was probably about anywhere from 15,000 to 20,000. That it was really small when I went.
And I was thinking, well, that's a lot to have grown for this time frame.
It was, and it's all been growing exponentially, mostly through word of mouth. However, in 1997, I believe there was an article in the Wired magazine that pretty much started broadcasting it to a larger audience that, you know, this really cool art thing is out there in the desert. And it was pretty kind of raw. I mean, the Cacophony Society being paired with these just group of friends really made it more of almost a little anarchistic. And they would go out there and they would have drive-by shooting ranges. And so there was an element of danger when you went out there. Drive-by shooting ranges. They would blow stuff up. Big art with, you know, fire. And when I went in 1998, the feeling for when I went, it was still really raw. I mean, I think it was during the time where industrial music and all that was actually pretty big. So the art was really out there, and very, very few kids. In fact, I don't even remember if I saw a child there in 1998. So it was definitely adult oriented at the time. A lot of the what we call crusty old burners and that from that time period now start, you know, seeing the changes being much, much watered down. The bigger it grew, the more that it called riding the edge. To be able to have it still kind of maintain its rawness, but yet grow and be safe, there needed to be some minimal rules that were put in place. Like at that time now, there's no longer firearms allowed. You can't have explosives and fireworks anymore unless they're like actually
approved.
Approved, yes, thank you. And worked in a very tight, controlled style.
When you went in 98, did someone still run in and turn and burn the man? I know that there was a point where a participant would run in.
I believe so, because at the time, the peer group safety department called the Rangers were present in 98, but there were not that many of them. And my husband and I were actually participated as an Alpha Ranger and held the perimeter during that time. So it was hugely different than it is now. Everybody was like sitting down and the man was still on a hay bale on the ground. So it was definitely completely different.
Well, tell me about your role as an Alpha Ranger.
Basically, I was just standing and holding the perimeter of the man, making sure that, you know, everybody was sitting down and behaving themselves and nobody decided to get closer where it was more dangerous to the actual flames.
Still with 20,000 people?
Did you have any difficulties? Did people actually try to?
At the time, actually, my little group of people that was in front of me were actually pretty good. And we only had one person, and I think I had to get the people that were sitting in front and around me kind of to do a kind of peer shaming for him to please, like, sit down. Mm-hmm. But other than that, they all cooperated.
Fortunately,
yes.
I think originally, too, when at the very beginning, it was a summer solstice thing. It's my recollection. Right around June 20th, something like that.
Yeah, and I think when it ended up moving out to Black Rock City and out in the desert there is when they moved it to the Labor Day weekend. Because when I went in 98, it was definitely Labor Day.
It would have been awfully wet.
Now, the location, of course, has changed.
Well, the location is still Black Rock Desert, but they have moved it around. In the early days, there wasn't a gate road. They didn't have the trash fence set up. You basically drove off of the pavement onto the desert playa, which is basically a dry lake bed, and you met up with maybe somebody sitting at a table or whatever, a little group, and you were given coordinates, GPS coordinates, and so you had to drive out and try to find where everybody actually was camping. And this was before they actually set it up as a city.
Easy to get lost out there.
Yeah, I mean, even with 60,000 people, you drive out there, and if it weren't for the flags, you think you're going to see these people. You do not see. The horizon's just enough to filter it. And you're like, I think it's over there. I kind of see darkness. I think that's people.
Sound doesn't carry.
No, you do not hear that sound from that far away. You're a good 7 miles off the road. And the way they position it, it's kind of a curved road out there. You do not hear that sound. You got to be pretty close, actually, to the city. So, I mean, even though there's noise 24 hours a day, yes, you can go on to some of the roads out there, and you can still get out to the outer skirts of the area, and you don't hear it. I mean, there's nothing to hold that sound in, so it's going up and out and out, and you just don't hear it.
Well, as a hiker, I can tell you that just walking around in the canyon here, you mm-hmm. can turn around a corner of a hill, and nobody will hear you, even with a whistle.
Yeah.
The acoustics are quite amazing.
Went out to that lake bed was during one of the amateur rocketry campouts in 96, and I remember when we got there, we were supposed to follow the orange sandbag trail mm-hmm. someone made out into the desert, and you're driving miles and miles, and you see nothing, and you don't want to lose sight of the sandbag trail, because otherwise you're on this dry lake bed 40 miles across, and mm-hmm. and you'd get lost. You would never be able to find the trail to the road again.
Well, and that was one of the reasons why Michael Danger Ranger set up the Rangers in the first place. It's because before the city was more structured as it is now, people basically camped very, you know, wherever they wanted. There was no real streets, and you can drive. The rule now is that you basically park your car and then it stays. But then you can get in your car and drive from camp to camp. They used to do the big sound camps like 2 or 3 miles away from where everybody was camping. So if you wanted to get to Rave, so to speak, you would have to get in your car. And it wasn't even a bike ride. It was a car ride. And when people were camping around, if you didn't have your campsite lit up appropriately, you basically were in danger of getting run over. And unfortunately, that has happened. I think with that and more people out there and the fact that there were some incidences of injury and death, that's when they started building more structure to the event and putting some rules on it so that it would keep people safe.
When you said in death, what was the story there?
Well, there's been a handful that I'm aware of. I know at one point there was a young woman who ended up getting run over in her tent while she was in her tent by a car driving. I don't remember the exact year that happened, but it was pretty early on. 96 or 97, I think, is when that occurred. There's been several suicides out there. I know of at least one that happened within the last 5 years. And then even, unfortunately, last year there was an accident. It's the first one that had occurred with a fatality in like 7 years.
I was in a camp in 2010. We had the only death of Burning Man that year. And it was, we don't know exactly what happened, except it was the woman in her 50s or 60s. She loved Burning Man. And she staggered out of her trailer and collapsed. And they took her by helicopter to Reno, and she died on the helicopter.
Was it heat exhaustion?
I never exactly found out the whole story. I did hear rumors that she had had health issues and she probably should not have been going. But she loved going.
Doing what made her happy.
Because the elements out there are pretty extreme. I mean, you've got highs during the day, sometimes in the triple digits, and it can drop to below freezing at night. So it's a wide range. And the atmosphere out there can just, you know, suck the moisture out of you. You really do need to be drinking. When Burning Man's... water, yes, definitely water. You need to be drinking water and hydrating, as they tell you in the survival guide. It's really, really important.
Piss clear.
Yes. One of the sandstorm or the dust storms can come up at any time. So it's pretty extreme.
And then you get rains and then all that sand turns to mud. And
That happened last year?
Yes.
This year?
Yeah, in 98, my husband and I lucked out. We had pretty much, I think we were the last people that were able to successfully get off the playa that year because it had started raining. And I remember loading up our final gear and just hightailing it out of there, fishtailing the entire time until we hit pavement. And then I heard rumors that people had been stuck there for several days, up to a week after that.
Lovely.
And Tara, you took your kids
I took my kids this year. We arrived Tuesday after the rain. Thank goodness. It was hard enough with three kids by myself, but I don't know what I would have done if I had to deal with the rain as well.
What are the ages of your kids?
17, 12, and 7.
So who is the more durable? The 7-year-old?
Actually,
kids usually just go for it.
Yeah, my boys, 12 and 7, we were together the whole time. They did not leave my side except in the morning when they went to our neighbor camp for bacon. It took them a couple of days, but to watch them change, watch them soften, give strangers hugs and hand out the necklaces that they had made. They worked and made ceramic necklaces, so they just fell into it. It was it came natural. My daughter did her own thing.
And people more her age, and they kind of...
No, she didn't connect. My daughter's more of a quiet old soul. She's an artist, and so she spent a lot of time out in Deep Playa and out with the artwork. It was a spiritual journey for her, definitely. She's not a partying teenager, so it was...
Finding her muse.
Mm-hmm.
Or muses, plural, yeah. I would guess.
And I don't know if she'll go back. My boys want to go back. They can't wait. She had a wonderful experience.
Now, what did they know before... You went.
Oh, I showed them videos. I shared my experience. I'm very open with them about almost everything. And their father goes as well. It was very different. They experienced kind of two extreme lives, so it's a little different. They're not. I know there were kids out there that were practically born out there, and it was neat to meet those kids and the parents, where it was part of their family tradition. And Kidsville is a fantastically established camp that is just. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful place. That was where we traveled to every day. That was our goal.
Well, tell me about Kidsville.
Kidsville is the largest theme camp, from what I understand. A
village,
yes. And there's a mayor. They have all these setups like Burning Man geared down for kids. So the climbing structures, they have their own little cars and activities. They have Black Rock Scouts with merit badges. And they have where the kids, and it's not just about entertainment, you know, well, yeah, it's participation, but the kids go out, they'll go meet up with rangers, or they'll learn about cleanup, they'll learn about, they go over the 10 principles, that's a major part of the scout program. We only participated in one event, just because it would take us 6 or 7 hours to get to Kidsville, so we missed a lot, but it's just such a fun little village. I'm not sure, we didn't spend a lot of time there, but the time we did, it was neat to talk with other parents and how they brought in Burning Man principles into their just their family lifestyle at home. And
can you give me an example of what you remember someone sharing with you?
Gifting was a big one. Leave no trace, radical self-reliance were some of the big principles that I heard parents give.
Well, tell me about radical self-reliance.
The kids, we have the kids do as much for themselves as possible. And experiencing
self-sufficient mothering.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Hovering, helicoptering.
Yeah, I took my kids out there too in 2013. I had a 4-year-old boy and a 7-year-old boy. It was a similar experience. We did not camp at Kidville. We camped on our own.
So how far is Kidville? You said it was a 6 or 7 hour traveling.
Where were you at when you took your kids around?
I was at D and 345.
We were at 245 and J. So mm-hmm. We were kind of out there. But it was more, I remember my burn and how important it was to just follow when you go out there. You don't have a set... You don't really have an agenda or schedule. You just follow wherever you feel led. I'm not sure how to explain that.
Mm-hmm. Just whatever catches your interest or eye.
Yeah, so my kids would take turns, and I'd say, okay, we need to get over to 530 and G, where Kidsville is. So we need to wind through the city and get there. But if you see something that looks interesting, if you want to stop at a camp, if you want to stop and talk to someone, climb something, then we will. But they took turns, and... So it sounds like that's something you did too.
Oh, every trampoline. We hit every trampoline. Anything they could climb on. It was super fun. I have just amazing memories of them. Mm-hmm. I have some pictures at my desk where they're wearing their goggles. My 4-year-old's wearing these huge, huge goggles on his head, and they're dark, so you can't see his eyes. And he's a towhead blonde, and his hair's just fluffed because the wind and the dirt has been in it all day. And he's got this great turn, and he's sitting in one of the pews in the church trap where someone was playing at the organ. We were taking a break in the shade of that piece of art. And just, this is such a great shot, and there's dust in the background. And I have another one of the kids, and I let them go shirtless, and I let them be without shoes so that they could experience kind of the immersion in the culture too.
One of my pictures of my kids was used for the Kidsville site because we took the love sculpture, mm-hmm. and each one of us were on a different love letter, and their personalities came out, and they're covered in dust, and each mm-hmm. one of us, and I'm sitting in the just kind of like, mm-hmm. inclusion. I mean, they, at one point, all of us were topless, all 4 of us just out there, riding across the playa, feeling free, and it was so, we were prior Mormon, and so for my kids to have that experience, living in that lifestyle, just which is in its own right, you know, a beautiful way to live. And then to go to Burning Man was just two extremes. And for them to see them come alive. And then how they are at school. I mean, having parent-teacher conferences with my boys after a couple months after Burning Man. And the changes that their teachers noticed. Their responsibility. I mean, my son, I thought he was going to have to repeat 5th grade. And he's just, I don't have to say anything about his homework. He is on top of it. He is responsible. He is so helpful with his younger brother. Cleaning the house. I mean, it changed them, and they are not as concerned with what's going on with social, you know, with their kids as far as whether their hair is messed up or their clothes are. My son was saying, Mom, I wore a dress at Burning Man. I don't care.
And what about with your kids? Did you notice a difference?
My kids didn't wear dresses. I don't know about quite that particular aspect. But, no, the thing that for our kids, they don't have a religious background of any kind, and so they really had never had like a filtered version of anything in the world, and so I saw no like shocking moments from them. Nothing where they're like, whoa, that's different or extreme. Not because they had been exposed to it before, but because we just have tried to show them all kinds of things. So whether it was car racing or tractor shows, they had a diverse exposure already, so to go out there, and they knew that we went already. So they were just excited to experience what we would come back and say, we saw this giant flaming thing. I couldn't tell you enough about the flames. So I had already prepared them with, you can climb, you can see, you'll have flames, and there'll be lights, and we'll go out late. And so there were so many things that they don't get in their normal world that they were all prepared for out there, too. Yeah. So for me, it was kind of a different sort of, you guys can ride your bike right there, whatever. You want to go barefoot? Okay. you know, a couple of times we run a couple of things and I'm all, oh my God, there's no railing. Okay, I'm not going to hover too much, but please don't fall, right?
Especially with the 4-year-old, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. And they got Playa names, and he was Danger Boy because he would climb everything without me being there. And so it was a little heart race a couple of times, but everybody was fine. And we did an art car that year, and it was fun to have them out there with the art car and everything. I found that actually we changed up our whole experience. So I actually had to write down how many times. So that was my third year with the kids. So we changed up our whole experience. So otherwise, you're out there and sometimes you'll party all night, go out and just spend all night out there and see what happens. You'll come back and sleep in the day. Well, you can't do that when you got your kids. So you kind of got to change things up, right? But I started to find people love to interact with the kids too.
Very
and
much.
And so they, my children also experienced the whole concept of gifting too. Mm-hmm. So once they just, because we had pins that we were giving away that were shaped like wings from a classic airline, you know, wings that you get on a pin on a airplane. Once they discovered the concept of gifting, oh, they couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah.
And then every art car, they wanted to go on every art car. And so people, because you have the kids, some people were like, oh, whatever. So it was a whole different kind of experience. And then the people wanted to interact with the kids and give them this really great experience, too. So they got all the swag. We're like, Mom, Dad, we'll see you.
Yeah, I got way more this year than I did.
Yeah.
Now, did you feel that it was, I felt like I had another virgin burn going with my kids, seeing it through their eyes, and it was so much harder than going on my own. And everything was, it felt like a new, I was making rookie mistakes. I didn't make my first burn.
Hmm.
Did you experience anything?
We were planners, my husband and I, so we were pretty intense on high monitoring of their fluid intake, sunscreen. Like, we're going to let you do your stuff, but we're still monitoring.
I want my listeners to know that she have notes. She has notes here. So this
only
is an organized
one.
I had brought a plastic pool and a pump water sprayer, and I'm like, you're standing there, and I'm hosing you down, and I lubed them up with the lotion at night. Oh, you can do this, but we're still going to make sure you can come home unbroken.
Yeah, we did. I feel like I did okay, and I learned a lot, and I followed a lot of the tips that were on the Kidsville website.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of information there for families. It was just little things. I didn't anticipate how long it would take to get out of camp every morning, or the bickering and the fighting, and constantly concerned about that my neighbors were driving them nuts. They didn't come to Burning Man to hear a bunch of kids fighting in the morning.
It sounds like a regular adult camp.
I was just going to say, I had more drama at the neighbors next to me and their own parents. Like, I had a mother and a daughter one year next to me, and I thought we were gonna have to call the Rangers because they were arguing. Who knows what they're arguing about, but it was loud and it was spilling out into the street, and that was exciting.
I really enjoyed seeing another side of Burning Man, was the reaction of people around us to my kids. And we all had our heads shaved, and so they looked, and my kids, they just fit right in as far as their outfits. So they just look like these little, people would take pictures of us, and this little burner family. But it was more people taking time to get down on their level for just a moment, give them a hug, hand them something, talk to them. My son had a little water bottle. He'd go around and ask people, can I squirt you with water? And they would take the time, and you could see them. Yes, they're adult children running around at Burning Man, but then you could see them change just a bit, where their focus wasn't going to the next dance or running. They just stopped for a minute, connected with my kids, got down, played with them. And the connection, that was one of my favorite things about the whole experience, with what my kids learned about human connection. It was powerful for me on my first burn. It's powerful for everyone I've talked to who's gone for years and years. And so to see my kids experience that was priceless.
Yeah, one of the things that drove us out there, I mean, never mind kids, but some of our first years when we were like, why are we going to do this? So it wasn't the music. I mean, it wasn't music. It was the art and the creativity and the real-time interaction that we were anticipating, like on a whole new level of participatory. So getting ready for the full immersion in this participatory environment, whether it was from the people walking by your camp in the daytime to the nighttime, to what would happen when you're at a piece of art and you have this amazing conversation, and then the radical, like, living, can I survive a week in the desert with porta potties and brought in water? It was sort of that's what drove us out there, was why did I want to do this thing? I don't know. I want to go out there and just see if I can make it.
Yeah, there's a saying that some people come for the art but then stay for the culture and in the community.
Definitely.
And I've definitely was my experience.
Well, let's share the Playa names that you have now.
I only have one. It was, and it's crafty. with a K. When we went out there the first year, we did not bring a gift, though, so feeling pretty bad. So my husband and I are sitting there, and being ready to survive, had brought everything except the kitchen sink. So we had baling wire and pliers. And so we sat there with our baling wire and our pliers and some string that we had, and we made little men out of the baling wire, and that turned into our gift. And so then I got to be crafty, and he became low-tech, because those were our abilities at the time, but it worked. So then they've stuck.
Are these plan names ones that you give yourselves or other ones?
Generally, a gifted name is fun, is best. I'm not going to say, I don't even think you should put judgment on that. Treasured, maybe that's a gift. That's the way to look at it. Is self-naming is fun. Going to the book, because there's a place where you can go get names, like out of botanical books and things like that. But a gifted name from a moment is really kind of cool.
And you, Candace?
In any of my hobbies, nicknames don't seem to stick with me. It always comes down to just calling me by my first name. I'm not quite sure why.
But you do have your Facebook as Can and then Das, and so that's good.
Yeah, that was just to avoid having my last name on Facebook.
Well, I always thought of it as your client name anyway.
And you can dance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
But I borrowed that idea from my friend Sheila.
First of all, you really don't need a nickname. I've been going 10 years, and I didn't get a nickname that actually kind of stuck until my 9th year. And so one of my friends wanted to nickname Amazing, and one of my friends wanted to name me Asian Dave, because there were so many Daves in our camp. Someone came up with the idea of combining them into the Amazian.
It's Amazian. I like that.
So that's the one I'm sticking with for right now anyway.
A couple of people have brought up, but they didn't stick.
Michael. Yeah.
Yeah, I always liked the name Tara. I thought that was pretty. So someone said, well, your play name should be Tara. But
and Paintbrush. Basically, the genesis of that is I paint. I have brought some of my paintings out to the playa. I pretty much had to pick it myself because I'm also a Black Rock Ranger, and they want you to have a handle for on the radio so that it's very unique and clear and easy to pronounce. So Paintbrush just kind of stuck. And so that's basically what I'm starting to be called now.
Now tell me some of the outfits that you've chosen over the years, or do you just like to go as is?
No, I love dressing up. That's one of the main reasons I love going there, and it could be anything.
I.e.?
Well, I dressed as a cheerleader for a while last year. That was kind of fun.
And what were your playa school colors?
Red. And what was really amazing was that same time of day that I chose to wear that, I ran into an art car full of about 30 cheerleaders who were all matching. It was a day full of serendipity, and I think most of the people here will tell you that at Burning Man, there always seem to be some serendipitous moments that happen.
Very. Yes. Very.
From what I understand, because I have not attended any Burning Man events, more than one outfit is usually brought.
I bring at least two per day.
Yeah.
So per day, okay.
Because it is really hot during the day and really cold at night, so you have to have at least that going for you.
So what kind of fashionista are you? How many change of clothing do you have over the...
Like I said, I have at least two per day, and sometimes I'll have another one in there.
Okay.
So
do my more risque at night, because I'm a little modest still, a little bit of coverage, but I feel a little bit better in the darkness.
Provided it's a little warmer that night. Most of the time in the night is when the fur comes out.
Yes.
Fur is big up there.
Fur, and not a whole lot underneath, though. You get the fur coats, and then you get the more risque stuff.
Yeah,
you take off and
you're
like,
really though, trapping a lot of warmth. Put a pair of fishnets on, a pair of knee-high boots, a little bit of glove on your hand, and you can almost go with just a tank top. It depends. Like one evening there was lightning. I don't remember what year this was, but there was lightning and light little bits of rain out there. Now, probably not the best time to be riding around on your bicycle, but fabulous, because it wasn't really that cold. So, I mean, I remember being in a tank top at that point.
Yeah, 2012, I remember being out in deep playa and watching all these lightning strikes that looked like they were hitting around camp. It was like, wow.
Scary.
I don't know. It was actually amazing. But
it would be cool to see, but
when you're right in the city, you can't even hear the strikes because of the sound counts. it's louder than the lightning.
Does anybody else volunteer other than paintbrush doing ranger? Have you done any other volunteering positions?
Yes, I also have, for the last 5 years, have been volunteering as a temple guardian. Basically what that means is I hold space and am kind of walking around very quietly and non-obtrusive, just making sure that everybody who's visiting the temple is safe. Most of the time what I've done is, you know, a couple of the structures, especially that one that was very open and canyon-like, and I believe that was in 2011, mm-hmm. was that about right?
Yeah,
it was very kind of open air. The way that the structure was...
Actually, it was 10.
That was 10?
Yeah.
That's yeah, you're right.
That's where my wife went.
Yeah, that one, the way it was built, it was not climbable. But people tried to just cover our temple in all kinds of little memorabilia, notes, little things that they want to give up, honoring a loved one that has just recently passed. People even put loved ones' ashes in the temple. And by the end of the week, all that prime real estate of trying to write in there was at least on reachable level, was starting to get very thin. So people were trying to climb a little bit higher. And so on my shift that year, I basically was going around saying, please don't climb, please don't climb. But for the most part, it's basically just watching everybody and kind of seeing them go through their grief process or celebratory. My favorite time to actually be a temple guardian is on Friday evening, just around sunset. At any given time at the temple, there could be 3, 4, 5 weddings going on at the same time. So it was kind of a special time to see that. This year, there was one woman who I was just standing back and watching, and she looked a little distressed. And what I saw her do was pull a great big box down from one of the shelves that was in the temple. And she got down on it, and she looked like she was struggling with it. And I was about to go up and help her take it down, but she managed. But I kind of just very respectfully kept my distance and watched her do this as she ripped open up the box and started going through the contents of the box. And then I overheard another participant go up to her and try to interact with her, and she did relay to them that she had just had tried to commit suicide several months earlier, and all of the contents of the box were like reminding her of that time, and she was trying to get rid of it, you know, that all those negative thoughts. And she did ask the participant to go away so she can respectfully deal with that herself. But I kind of sat back and stayed and held space for her, making sure that, you know, she was able to process that time in a very safe, respectful, and kind of manner.
I think that's something that not many people are aware of that's present at Burning Man. They think of Burning Man as this big party out in the desert with, you know, just a bunch of ravers, drugs, sex, people running around naked. And it's, it can be a very spiritual journey, and that's transformational and healing. Not just for losing a loved one. I mean, my daughter put her journal this year in the temple, and it was this beautiful journal she made. It was hand-bound. She's an artist, just a phenomenal artist, and very artistic. I was having a really hard time letting it go, and it's not mine. But what it represented for her the last few years and some struggles that she's had, and letting it go, and it was releasing. And I had my own experience, my first burn, and it was about releasing something from the past that I, like with that woman, and it was so incredibly healing for me. And then my children, to see them experience that as well, the energy in the temple is something, if you aren't spiritual, it doesn't matter, you go in there. My boys went in there and immediately they became quiet, and they each kind of walked around quietly, and I didn't tell them, they knew a little bit about the temple, but not, I wanted to see what they would experience for children, and it was beautiful, and they each wrote on the walls, and I didn't see what they wrote. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I saw what my 7-year-old wrote. It was just a beautiful response to a question that a stranger asked him. And it's something people don't know about Burning Man, that it's, there's so many different elements to the experience.
Now, of course, some of those drugs and sexual encounters have occurred over the years. But as you said, yeah, people expect it to be front and centered in your face all the time.
No.
And that's one of the things I wanted to discuss today, too.
You usually have to go find it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a city. So it's like someone saying, okay, if you go to San Francisco or Chicago, what's that like? It's like, well, what part of it? You could drive yourself crazy trying to see everything that's in the Who, What, Where book that details all the schedule and things. But I tell people that go there for the first time, you know, it's nice to look at those things, but just enjoy where you are, because chances are there are lots of awesome things happening just around you. Just be open to it.
Just see and be present.
Rather than crisscrossing the city and going 2 miles this way, 2 miles this way to try to meet some sort of schedule that you make.
Yeah, they do give you, you know, the who, what, where, when book, and it's gotten quite thick over the years, and it's almost like a little catalog of all kinds of activities going on. But in the last 3 years that I went, I have not opened that book up once.
Usually we're open up on the way home.
Yeah, on the way home going, that happened.
All right.
So can you share with my listeners the approximate size of the city?
70,000.
5 miles by 3 miles. Mm-hmm. It's a pentagon shape, right? Bound by a trash fence. That's the main footprint.
Well, let's put it this way. Every year they actually do a 50-kilometer race out there. My husband is an ultra runner, and it's, I believe, 5 times around along the Pentagon trash fence, and that's your 62 miles.
With an airport.
Mm. Yes, there is.
Full-functioning airport. I had in 2013, it was Cargo Cult, so we did a small art car, comparatively speaking, to some of the other ones, which was based on a VW Bug, and it was an airplane, cardboard-covered airplane, and we helped out the Black Rock Scouts. I volunteered with the Black Rock Scouts that year and drove them in one of their field trips out to the airport, because I'm like, well, we might get an in-depth tour of the airport, which we did. So we got to walk out onto the tarmac, and they allow people who fly into the airport to camp by their planes. And you have to have special clearance or call signs to effectively land at this airport, because you are landing out there on the desert, so the terrain is different, downdrafts, and everything about landing in high desert too. So they're going to call in, when you call in to land, they're going to clear you with you have to have the password before they want you to come in and land, because they want to make sure that you're prepared for the scenario that you're coming into. So that was really fascinating. They have a full customs, and they have they said that they will process more flights per day, because they don't have a lighted air field, so it's all only daytime flights. But they will process more flights per day there than down in Vegas, because of the number of little planes that are coming in daily. So they are pumping people through there.
I got to fly over the city in 2011. Just if you go out to the airport, you know someone, or if you have friends who know someone, you can possibly get a ride out there. And it's an interesting thing to do.
Did you take photos, aerial photos?
I had a friend volunteer to do customs one year.
Mm-hmm.
She said that a lot of people were disappointed that she didn't demand cavity searches.
Well, and we are a fairly full-functioning city, because we also have a field hospital called Rampart. Police officers of various different counties are out there, and this is the first year that they actually had more of a camp in the city and not just a compound like right outside the city. So even the police officers now that are out there are starting to become a little bit more integrated into the culture, which is nice.
They also have a fire department.
And a fire department, yes. Ambulances on site. And even though some of the positions, the emergency positions, are paid, a great majority of them are volunteer nurses, doctors, psychologists, because the city out there is intense, and you're put into a stressful situation, and emotions can run high, stress levels can get up. So we have all of that out there available for people that are in need.
Well, let's talk about some of the projects, shall we say, that have been built by all of you. Want to share some of those?
Well, Sacramento has a large regional contingent that go to Burning Man. I believe Sacramento has the second most number of people of any city that goes to Burning Man. And over the last couple of years, we've become very involved in producing art projects. And there have been two fairly large structures that were put up 2 and 3 years ago by the Sacramento contingent. And then last year, we had a smaller interactive booth right directly underneath the man, basically.
Describe them for me.
3 years ago, it was a treehouse. And the reason was Sacramento is known as Tree City, USA. So they decided to build a treehouse, and then it got burned on Thursday night, along with a lot of other pieces of art. And then 2 years ago was the Playa Queen, which was a mock-up of a steamboat with a paddle wheeler.
Nice.
And it also burned on Thursday night. And then last year we did a takeoff on AAA, And instead of AAA, we did the PTA, or the Playa Travel Association, and we offered various services to weary travelers as they made their way around the tents surrounding the man himself.
Now, have there been any projects where you decided not to burn but to bring them back with you? Because I know a lot of people do that, and they end up...
In the Sacramento area, we've been starting to talk about that, and how we've gotten involved so far the last couple of years is we've all had the opportunity to participate in what's called the CORE projects, or the Circle of Regional Effigies. And Burning Man invited us to, as a region, to build something, some kind of art that would represent us as a community. And that's why we had the treehouse, Arborea is what we called it, and then the Playa Queen. But this year, they switched things up a little bit. They didn't have the CORE project. They did what they called a sook. And my understanding is that they wanted to kind of bring back that element of participatory kind of art, performance art, and less of a big showcase of people going around looking at the big art, but more interaction,
a little more intimate.
Because
I know some pieces have been donated to arts and
right, Reno and San Francisco, and I believe even like to the Fernley area have done that. And it's our dream here in Sacramento to also get to that point where we can build something that's a little bit more permanent and then bring it back and have it shown here in Sacramento, but we haven't quite gotten to that part yet.
So let's talk about the length of Burning Man. Some people think it's 2 days, some people think it's a month. Nobody's hearing the actual facts. So what are the stats? The length of the event, price of the event, and the failed lottery attempt?
Officially, it has a date range.
It's a week.
It's 1 week. This year, it changed its opening time to open on Sunday. But traditionally, it's midnight of that Monday morning, that Monday before Labor Day. And then, isn't it officially basically over on
Monday?
On Monday,
Monday
following
the Labor
after
Day.
That. Yeah.
Always ends on Labor Day. Huh?
That's what your ticket buys you. Entrance to. Now, volunteer people are out there getting the city ready
well in advance.
Are we talking a month at least?
Yeah, there are some people that go out there and can spend anywhere from 2 to 3 months out there. Got people pretty much showing up in the beginning of August who lay what's called the Golden Spike, which is where the man will eventually rise. And then DPW, or the Department of Public Works, our version of it, goes out there and they start building the center camp and laying out the roads of the street, the city. And so they're out there for quite a while. And then usually like a week right before Burning Man is officially opened is when a majority of the theme camps then come out, the bigger ones that have gotten placement, and they'll start building up their structure. So by the time a typical participant shows up on either Sunday or that Monday morning, the city is in full swing.
You might want to mention, too, for anyone who doesn't know that the layout, too, is like
a horseshoe.
It's a horseshoe, but just the way the streets are, it's a clock and, you know, it's not that difficult.
Well, it's kind of amphitheater shaped more, isn't it? Would you say it's... Because the horseshoe is more of a capital U, whereas
that's how it's shaped.
It's almost like a clam. It's a really tight C, let's say that.
Yeah, that sounds better.
Well, on a face clock, it goes from 2 o'clock to 10 o'clock on a face clock. The temple is typically at on a clock face at midnight or noon, and the man would be right dead in the center.
So how long does it take to break it all down after everybody has left?
Well, typically everybody breaks down probably
as
quickly as possible. I know people are out of there like in a flash. And this year was my first year of staying a lot later than I usually do. I was there on Wednesday. At that point, they were taking things down very quickly. Most of the art is already down at that point. And then they start doing the moop spread. I think by that following Friday is when they really want the Bureau of Land Management wants most of the people off. But you're going to have a few stragglers. And then DPW moves its base to Gerlach, which is our closest town, and they come back in slowly to do a spread of what we call mooping, which is matter out of place, to try to restore the playa back to its original positions.
How much does this cost?
$320 this year?
No, $390.
Yeah, if you count, I mean, the actual ticket price was $380, but if you count the fees for for mailing and all that, I think it ended up coming up to about $390. And in addition to that, we were also required for the first time this year to buy every vehicle that was brought on needed a $40 vehicle pass.
Which they only had half of the total count of tickets to encourage carpooling.
Yes.
Well, then they have low-income tickets that you can apply for.
Mm-hmm. And that
they're very limited. Paid. I think they're only like 4,000 of those, I think, out of...
Like 180?
And it was 180.
And they do sell a handful of tickets at an increased price for those with means. And they usually put those out as pre-sale. And those kind of offset the price of the low-income.
Oh, those are like six-something.
Yeah, 625, I thought.
Yeah.
And they put them out before Christmas, so if you're well off, you can give one to your...
Then you don't...
And then secure a place.
Yeah,
it's
you don't
difficult
have to worry
to
about the lottery.
Is it ran out?
It's actually not a lottery anymore.
Yeah, it's not a lottery anymore.
It's
now
first come, first serve.
But they do want you to fill out an online profile, and it's through the profile then that when it gets open, first come, first serve, that you go through your profile. So it was one of their ways of being able to kind of cut down on scalping.
Makes sense.
And tickets sold out in 38 minutes this year.
And that's why this is probably the last, 2-3 years, they've held all the ticket prices at the same level. Because prior to that, they were trying to encourage people to buy their tickets early so that they would have tiered tickets. But the year that it sold out, from that year forward, and I believe that was 2012, was the first year it sold out. From that point forward, it's just been a flat amount.
Now, some of you left for a while, then returned. So can you share your experiences of what it was like before and after? What changes you noticed?
Bigger, more people.
Well, mine was probably the most stark contrast. In 1998, I mean, it was comparatively tiny. Almost everything just happened out on the Esplanade, and everybody else was just, which is our like main drag where that differentiates where the theme camps are from where the art on the playa is. And so all the most interactive art, even to this day, and theme camps are usually given that prime real estate. But back then, that's where everything was happening, period. You might have found something here or there, but there were a few streets in 98, but then when I went back in 2009, it was just like, wow, oh my God, it was huge at that point. The man was a lot higher than being on a hay bale. I had kept in touch over that 11-year hiatus, but because I was very involved in the local community at the time when I was living back in Chicago. So I was engaged in hearing stories of people coming back from Burning Man at various different times and always wanting the urge to go back. So it was always there for me. It's just that life got in the way with children and not being able to get the time away, especially coming from that distance. So that was the reason why I had to wait so long to go back. But my husband and I went back in 2009 when we were on the playa. At that point, our kids were grown up, and we were like, you know what, next year we're driving from California. And sure enough, in 2010, we moved to California, and I've been back every year since.
And you said more people. You noticed that right away when you returned?
The very first year I went was 2003, and I think it was like 32,000 at that point. At that time, it was bigger than any other camping type event I'd ever been to, and I remember making the mistake of being on the far end of the city then when nightfall came, trying to get back to my camp at 2 in the morning, and I realized when it's all lit up, the neighborhood looks different. And it's kind of hard to find what your camp looks like at night when it's all lit up if you weren't used to walking around it a bunch of times before you strike off 2 miles in that direction. But it keeps growing and there's more stuff. So, that first year I went, it was also funny because that was when the Temple of Wow had put out 4 lasers from the man, one going to the 12 o'clock position, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and 9 o'clock, which was really handy to know to navigate. But after the man burned on Sunday, there were a lot of lost people around going,
well, that's a big problem, because as art, big art pieces are burned throughout the, you know, because usually this is the year, from my understanding, the most art was burnt on the playa this year. And so they started burning stuff like on Wednesday. And so then more gets burnt on Thursday and more on Friday, and then finally the man on Saturday, and more of your landmarks start dissipating. And so it's very easy to get disorientated, exactly when, especially if you're out on the playa. But one of the things that I've found to learn to navigate the city a little bit better is they do give you maps, and there is street marks and street signs and stuff that you can tell. But it's still difficult.
People start collecting souvenirs and all the signs start disappearing.
Yes. Earlier than Sunday now.
So you don't have that then.
And if you get caught in a dust storm, that was our problem, was being out. We were trying to get from one end because we were over in 2:30 and we traveled all the way around the city with my boys that day. And we started to come out from 10 o'clock to head straight across, you know, easy, head straight across to 2:30. And that huge, massive dust storm that hit, it took us a couple hours and we got lost and couldn't see at that point some of the art that were landmarks that we would see to know that we were going in a straight line to our street. They were gone. So we ended up going way out. But, you know, it's an adventure. We're all alive.
We'll trap this up to encourage those that have been on the fence about attending Burning Man. Can you take turns, share your experience and why someone should attend, what they would receive from it, what you believe they would receive from participating in this event?
One of the big things that keeps me going back is the opportunity to experience large-scale art on a massive scale. I can't imagine any other place, really, even when I think of art places. The amount of creativity that you get there is super inspirational. So I want to go back every time to reinvigorate my own self and be inspired by what others have accomplished, and be surrounded for a week.
I like how even massive dust storms or anything that initially might sound like a setback can turn into a really cool experience. Example, I got caught in one of those big dust storms, far side of the city from camp, started to try to push my bike through it, and realized I was going to get lost that way. Meanwhile, I noticed that there was a giant 20-sided dice art sculpture next to the road that someone had pulled a panel off, and there were people climbing in it for shelter. So I dropped my bike next to it and climbed in along with people, and we sat out about 3.5 hours the storm. But there were like 20 of us in there, and we had our own party in there. People started pulling things, food and drink that they had in their backpacks. There was a professional photographer there that was doing a creative costume a photo shoot in there. I mean, it was so much fun, and these are all random people I would never have had a conversation with, except that we were both seeking shelter from the dust storm. We were having so much fun that we didn't realize that the storm had stopped until somebody walked up and said, "Hi, does anybody want a lightsaber? I've got boxes of them that I'm sharing for everyone, just so long as you promise to show up at Thursday night at the Man. We want to have the world's largest lightsaber fight at sunset." "Oh, I'll take one." And that was how that whole thing ended. It's just like, where else can you go and have stuff like that happen? Everything is a rabbit hole, and you have a cool event if you're willing to go with it. If you fight it, you'll have a different experience.
Well, a couple things. On a personal level, I love to take photos. I'm not particularly good at it, but I do like to take them. I usually take over 2,000 photos in a week there. If the only reason you wanted to go was you thought there'd be good photos there, then go, because that alone would be a good enough reason. But in the bigger picture, it's basically the people. I mean, we can talk about the art, we can talk about all this other stuff, but really it's interactions with the people and the people you meet there, and then you find out that you're actually living in the same city as them. You never would have met them otherwise. And through Burning Man, I've gotten to meet so many local people that I am honored to spend time with, and without Burning Man, I never would have done that. And so I encourage you to go. And if you don't think you're able to go, I encourage you to come and join us locally at one of our local events.
It expands you on so many different levels, socially, emotionally, artistically. I have felt, I know, I love the word expanding, because I feel like when I've gone, every day something happens. I allow myself to be open to whoever I meet randomly, and because everyone has shed that their walls and the boundaries that we all carry with us around in this, you know, in this regular life default world, there's this capacity for connection that is just unreal. And in that space of such open, free, and very true connection. You find your view, your perception of life expanded. What limits you set for yourself or what you set for others, judgments for yourself or others or everything, it's like someone just shines a light on your path and you just see more of what's out there, what's possible, things you just couldn't comprehend before. You let yourself think deeper and larger. Can't say, oh, just emotionally or just with your family or just with work. It's with everything in your life. Every burner I've met has stories, multiple stories that are so beautiful that I feel it when they share it with me, and I want to cry with them.
My experiences have not been that dissimilar. I typically relate to the very first time I went, it was for the art. And I still go back for the art. The art is very inspirational for me. And you can see some of the most outstanding large-scale pieces that you would not really see anywhere else. And the fire art is phenomenal. Some of the explosions are just like, wow. And that you really would not be able to see anywhere else. I mean, the playa is a blank canvas, and the people and the art that are out there basically paint this whole canvas. And in the 7 years that I've gone, not one of those years has been the same. What keeps me coming back is all those experiences of meeting, having profound conversations with people that I would never have had in any other circumstances. And I too have experienced the expansion. And when I come back, sometimes it's difficult to get back into the normal routine of things, but even as I start integrating back into my normal routine, that experience has never fully left me. And I find ways of being able to integrate that into my everyday life, and it's been for the better.
One more thing, I feel like we've touched on a lot of the deep, more some of the more emotional, philosophical aspects of it. It is fun.
Yes, it is fun. It's fun.
So much fun.
As was mentioned, there are Burning Man regional events around the country, so check and see if any are held in your area. In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to Homestead National Monument of America in Beatrice, Nebraska. It's located on what's considered to be the first homesteader claim under the Homestead Act, the granting of free land to claimants. The first claim is considered to be that of Daniel Freeman on January 1, 1863, on this spot. His descendants agreed to sell the land to the government to make it the site of a national monument. Homesteading claims were comprised of 160 acres, based on a system still used today, the rectangular survey system of 1 square mile. 160 acres comprised 1/4 section of a square mile. More claims were made in 1913 than in any other year. In 1976, the Homestead Act was repealed, although Alaska was granted a 10-year extension, making Ken Deerdorf the last person to file a homestead claim in southwestern Alaska in 1974. Under the Act, the government distributed over 270 million acres in 30 states. Around 2 million homestead records exist, containing an estimated 3 million documents. The National Park Service is working on an obviously long-term project to digitize the records to make them available for historical and genealogical research. By the way, the Emancipation Proclamation and the Railroad Act were passed at the same time as the Homestead Act to move immigrants westward for settlement. One thing I love about this time of year is attending arts and crafts festivals, strolling through the booths, absorbing the fabulous creativity. A couple of weeks ago, I was a little blindsided by an artist's painted wood creations clearly inspired by fairy tales, Lewis Carroll, with a little steampunk thrown in. I felt like I had truly stepped into a rabbit hole of the imagination. I must have stood there for a good 10 minutes just staring. They are above and beyond whimsical. And he uses repurposed wood, which I appreciate. I could try to describe them, but you really do need to actually see them. His Facebook page only shows a few pieces, but check it to see when he's going to be in your area, if at all. His Facebook page is, all one word, Artisan of Wood JTB. It's A-R-T-I-S-A-N-O-F-W-O-O-D JTB. Do something different. Bill your doctor for the time spent in the waiting room.